Dear listeners, wherever you are on the road, in the office, or at home, on the couch, we welcome you to our podcast, BI for All Talks, your go-to podcast for all things surrounding business intelligence and data analytics from a Swiss perspective. This podcast is dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and trends from experts in the international and national field so you can stay up to date on the latest technologies, strategies, and best practices. From big data and machine learning to data visualization and predictive analytics, we cover it all. So sit back, relax, and get ready to learn something new. Today, we bring you Mohan Subramaniam, Professor of Strategy and Digital Transformation at IMD Business School in Lausanne, who shares his insights on the topic of a Swiss outlook on competitive strategy for the digital world. Mohan, welcome, and thank you so much for being here with us and taking the time to share your expertise with us on this interesting topic. I'm really excited about it. Welcome.
Thank you, Branka. I'm excited too.
So, Mohan, the first question for this episode is, who are you? Who is Mohan? Could you tell us a little bit more about yourself, your career, and your field of expertise?
Well, thank you, Branka. As you mentioned in the introduction, I'm a professor of strategy and digital transformation at IMD in Lausanne. I come fundamentally from a background of competitive strategy. I've been teaching competitive strategy for over 30 years. For most of that time, I was in Boston. I love it now that I'm now in Lausanne in Switzerland. My interests were about traditional competitive strategy, obviously, before everything changed around our world in terms of digital. Today, I'm predominantly focused on looking at, how do companies or how can companies drive competitive advantage in this new modern digital world.
Excellent. That sounds very, very interesting. Thank you, Mohan. And I know recently you have also published a book called The Future of Competitive Strategy. Could you briefly share its core messages with me and to our listeners? That would be great.
Oh, sure. Thank you. So this book is published by MIT Press. It came out in August 2022. It basically offers a new paradigm for competitive strategy for firms that want to be anchored in data and digital ecosystems and harness the new game-changing power of digital technologies in the modern world. It focuses on what I call legacy firms. So legacy firms are those who have built their legacies before the arrival of the internet. And I would say a majority of the Swiss firms, and especially the really famous large Swiss firms, all built their legacies before the arrival of the internet. So this book focuses on companies like those. Mm-hmm. And these companies, or these legacy companies, for the longest time, have anchored their competitive strategy largely around products and the industries in which they operate. 100% of the revenues, for example, come from their products. Not surprising. But if you look at some of the really most valuable companies in the world today, like the Facebooks and the Amazons, 100% often of their revenues come from data. So legacy firms have to start thinking that, how do we also get some value and revenues out of data in the way the digital platforms are doing, but also in a way which is relevant to our own traditional business models. And so the book is about looking at how these legacy companies can expand their business scope and enlarge their business canvas beyond products to data, and beyond industries to what I call digital ecosystems, which I'm sure we will talk about as we go along in this podcast.
That's fantastic. That's great. So what I'm hearing is that you are focusing a lot on data, and I assume that data is nothing new. Almost all legacy firms have some sort of data. So, but what is new about data for legacy firms?
That's a terrific question, Branka, okay, and goes into the heart of, you know, what the shift in mindset has to be for legacy firms in this new modern world. To explain or to discuss what is really different about modern data, let me give an example of someone who goes to, say, Barnes & Noble, you know, the famous bookstore, spends a couple of hours at that store, and then walks away, say, with one book. Think about the data that Barnes & Noble would have for this example. And now compare it with Amazon, where the same customer goes, spends 2 hours on their platform, and doesn't even buy a single book. And think about what is different about the data that Amazon gets as compared to what Barnes & Noble gets. I see the difference as what I call the difference between episodic data, which is what Barnes & Noble gets, and interactive data, which is what Amazon gets. Mm-hmm. So for Barnes & Noble, that data is an episode. Somebody bought a book. It is registered by the cash register. Nothing happens at that point when that book is sold. But thousands of such episodes, or millions of such episodes, then get aggregated in some form for analysis after the fact, which store is selling which book is selling, what are our margins, do we have enough inventory? All those kinds of analysis come from that kind of episodic data. But on the other hand, with Amazon, they can do all that, but in addition, there are some other things they can do. They can use data in real time, for example, that while this customer is browsing on the Amazon site, the, you know, the customer, he or she gets messages saying that, well, this book that you're looking for has many other authors have written similar books, or this particular author has written other books, or these are the kind of reviews that you may have. These are all experiences that the customer gets in real time because of the kind of data, the interactive data that Amazon is gathering. So fundamentally, the big difference between episodic and interactive data is that episodic data is generated through discrete events, whereas interactive data comes as a regular stream or a continuous stream which the company collects. Now, why is it significant? It's because of two fundamental differences. One is that interactive data comes from pinpointed sources. In the Barnes & Noble case, the data is aggregated. We don't track individuals necessarily. But with Amazon, you're tracking every individual customer or user. The data comes in much bigger volumes because obviously it's a continuous stream, and it helps build very powerful individual profiles that they know that this particular customer is looking at these kinds of books. And in the case of Amazon, it's not just books, it's a whole variety of other things too. The second very big difference is because of the use in real time. Now, episodic data you never use or you do not use in real time. The book is bought, you wait, you collect, aggregate, and then you use that data for insights. In the Amazon case, you saw that the data is being used in real time. Now, why is that? Because platforms fundamentally were designed for sharing data in real time. The Uber has to share data between drivers and riders in real time. But they realize that by sharing data in real time, there is the possibility of sharing it in a far more widespread manner that improves experiences for customers. So for example, say my daughter is waiting for a ride in a dangerous neighborhood late at night that Uber knows. in real time, it can share data with some app developers who can produce an app that gives a text message to me or my wife or a couple of our friends saying that she's waiting for a ride, she's taken the ride, she's reached. It becomes a safety feature. Important thing is that the value of that real-time data is gone after the real-time. That is, it is transient in nature. So it doesn't have any competitive elements to it. Even if you share it with your competitors, they cannot do much about it. There's no value for that data, for example, in the Uber case. If you send me some information after 3 days that your daughter took a ride in such and such a place, and it has no value. If I give that example, say, with a legacy firm, say Caterpillar. Caterpillar's excavator has just finished digging. And that data in real time, if it is shared with a concrete pourer or a fabricator, and God forbid, even Komatsu, the competitor, it adds value because you can start getting into coordinating projects. But at the same time, you're not losing anything, any competitive edge by sharing that data. Now, interactive data has that other element of being able to share data. And that is what adds a completely new dimension to data. And that is what drives a lot more explosive new value and power, which the legacy firms have yet to kind of tap into.
That is so interesting and a very interesting observation. And you're so right. Yeah. More to that. So when we talk to our clients, for example, they are very clear about their product strategy, but very much unclear about this, about their data strategy and what to do about with it. So what advice, based on what you just said, would you give these legacy firms about developing a data strategy based on all these facts now?
That's a great question. That really goes into the heart of the book, which is about competitive strategy in the world of data. Mm-hmm. Now, and also expanding or shifting our perspective of competitive strategy from products to data. I would broadly put what data strategy should be for legacy firms in three steps or three parts. One is how much of interactive data are you bringing in into your business models? Because as we saw in the earlier discussion, that interactive data opens a completely new dimension in terms of how you can use data as compared to episodic data. The second is, what do you do with that interactive data? You can use it to improve your internal efficiencies, the way many times we use aggregated episodic data for, but you can also now use it to drive new data-driven services and open new revenue streams beyond product revenue streams. That's the second one in terms of thinking about a strategy. Mm-hmm. And the third, to do these two things, you need to shift your focus from industries to digital ecosystems. You need to figure out what your digital ecosystems can be and how do you harness the power of interactive data in these new digital ecosystems.
Very interesting, very interesting. Could you elaborate a bit more on the ecosystem? So what are the digital ecosystems and how does it help legacy firms build one?
Great. So that is the second complementary part to interactive data. Interactive, understanding the difference between episodic and interactive data is one thing. Mm-hmm. Understanding digital ecosystems is the second thing. They're very important concepts that legacy firms need to get very familiar with. So digital ecosystems fundamentally are networks, and I call them networks of data generators and data recipients. And for most of us, it's very obvious when we see them in digital platforms. So Uber has a network of drivers and riders and app developers, and we understand that, right? What we still have to understand more clearly is that what are digital ecosystems for legacy firms? Most legacy firms are not platforms. They are based on value chains. And how do they or how should they conceive their digital ecosystems? So I look at it as a combination of production and consumption ecosystems. And to explain that, I would take an example of an auto company. Let's take Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how does Ford operate today? It has a value chain, which is fundamentally a network of a variety of different players, sometimes thousands of them. There are thousands of suppliers. There are multiple manufacturing plants, R&D centers, thousands of dealers and alliance partners. So it's all part of the value chain. And if you look at it as a network, that network becomes a base to start generating and sharing data. And that network started getting activated years back when IT services began. So IT services came in and started turning a value chain into a digital ecosystem, which I call a production ecosystem. This is the digital ecosystem in which legacy companies produce and sell. Now, with interactive data, this network has become much richer. So with IT services, the primary purpose of that digital ecosystem was to improve efficiencies. Essentially, what IT services did was to automate a lot of processes, gave data in terms of dashboards and stuff where we can take various decisions very quickly. But with interactive data, these efficiencies not only just go up. So Ford, for example, if it uses augmented reality, virtual reality in the paint shop to replace inspection of paint from visual means to, you know, through streaming interactive data coming from these new technologies, it clearly improves its efficiencies and quality control.
Right.
But interactive data can do other things too. If for a mattress, for example, it has sensors on its products, and now it is sensing heart rates and tossing and turning and even snoring. Okay, it can track all that. And it can do many things to the mattress. Because of that data, it can turn the shape or contours of the mattress in ways by which it can ensure optimal sleep quality. So now you are, and by giving that service, you are saying, okay, I can sell you the mattress for this price. But if you want the service by which we can ensure a better quality of sleep all along, can you give us $20 a month or $30 a month as subscription? And now you're generating new revenue streams from interactive data, managing it through your value chain or your, what I now call production ecosystems, right? So that is the production ecosystems part. But going back to the car example, there's the other part of this network, which is a network of what I call complements. So what are complements to cars? They are things without which the car would not have any demand. So if there are no roads, nobody's going to buy a car. If there are no gas stations, nobody's going to buy a car, right? If there are no independent service providers to kind of repair car tire, you know, breakdowns or things like that, the demand for cars will go down, right? So these complements are things that enhance the demand for products. But companies, generally, legacy companies never paid attention to it. You know that a light bulb needs wiring, electricity, and sockets, but no light bulb company in the legacy world paid any attention to wiring and electricity. Those were things to be taken care of by the customers, and they had to make the arrangements themselves. Now, that network, because of sensors and IoT, is evolving into a very powerful ecosystem, which I call the consumption ecosystem. So in cars, we now know that the location of a car is now, you can track it with the road that you are in. You get traffic data in real time. You even get data on potholes in real time. If you're running low on gas, you can go to the nearest gas station because all that is connected. And that's what I call a consumption ecosystem. That ecosystem is growing steadily as more and more objects get connected to the data the car generates. So in today's, some of Ford's models, I can say, hey, Alexa, I want coffee. And the nearest Starbucks knows exactly what time I'll arrive, knows exactly what my order is, keeps the right coffee at the right temperature for me to drive there, pick it up at the right temperature, go away when all the payments and things like that, everything happens in the background because I am now connected with all these different complements. So whoever thought that Starbucks would be a complement to a Ford car, but it is today. So that's what I call consumption ecosystems. These are digital ecosystems in which you're able to consume a product or a service. And so that's where I said digital ecosystems are a combination of production and consumption ecosystems. And you see how we are not only using these digital ecosystems to improve efficiency, but we are also using it to generate new revenue streams through new digital services.
It's so fascinating, isn't it? Like the technology is just moving us so forward. I love this. Could you maybe just, you gave us like such great examples on other companies and brands. Do you also have a few examples for Swiss companies?
Oh, absolutely. Right. Mm-hmm. So let's take, say, Mobiliar, right, the insurance company, and think yes. about how the insurance business has always been anchored on episodic data. So data has played a big role in insurance businesses. We all know that, you know, if you want to have profitability, an insurance company has to price premiums which are reasonable, but at the same time has to make sure that the risk is low so that the premium is basically profitable. And lowering risk happens with data. We have a lot of actuarial systems that insurance companies use. And essentially, they lower risk by having large pools of subscribers or customers so that the average risk comes down. And you're tracking average risk based on analyzing episodic data. Now, what is happening to a company like Mobiliar in the new world? Say, Mobiliar is insuring homes. And you know, these homes have risks of pipes bursting during winter, like what we are having when temperatures are going to below freezing.
Right. So
right. So these things are happening in my own home. I've had my pipes burst at some point in Boston. These things happen, and this is a risk. And of course, it becomes expensive for Mobiliar to compensate that risk if that damage happens. Now, if I have interactive data, if I have sensors on these pipes, I can track individual homes. Now, I'm not relying on average risk like in episodic data. I'm able to track individual risk to individual homes. I'm able to monitor it in real time. And if I know that some pipe is likely to burst, I can send an alert. This is the classic production ecosystem example that I can, through my production ecosystem, have a service by which the homeowner gets an alert saying, hey, your pipes are likely to freeze. But if I move into the consumption ecosystem, it could also be that when I understand that a pipe is about to freeze, I can connect the service to what are external entities to the pipe, which is, you know, faucets that can put hot water on automatically. So that even if the homeowner is not at home, it is taken care of. But you see how Mobiliar's business model now shifts. The earlier business model was about compensating risk, saying that, hey, if your pipes burst, I will compensate the risk.
Right.
But now it is about preventing risk. Okay. And so, and the whole thinking and ways by which you are generating value changes. It also opens up new competitive things for Mobiliar. Earlier, Mobiliar's advantage was because I've got the largest pool of homeowners and I have the lowest average risk. But today, smaller companies can take parts of your business because they don't have to rely on reducing average risk. They can track individual risk and give individual homes service. So there are big shifts happening in their world, in their competitive world, which they have to pay attention to. Another example I could give of a product company like Hilti. So
yes.
Hilti now has smart construction tools that can adapt its functions in terms of maybe the torque it uses or the pressure it uses or the speed at which certain things rotate, depending on the kind of job that it is doing, right? Again, the job may start generating interactive data for the tool to kind of respond to in an intelligent way and do the job more efficiently and effectively. But then there's a consumption ecosystem too, which is that while a contractor has just finished one part of the job with one tool, it may need another tool to follow. Now, if the person doesn't find that other tool in time, the customer loses money. So the tool might cost $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, but if you don't find the next tool, say in the next 2 hours or 3 hours, you might lose $100,000. So what Hilti is doing is that it is giving services by which it can, the construction worker is connected to other tools, other Hilti tools in terms of knowing what is the next one, what is the next step, where is it, so that the entire project is managed in ways of doing things efficiently. Now, you notice the shift, right? It's not just about selling the product. It is about selling a broader experience and also tracking what the product is doing in terms of how it is being used. And also the consumption ecosystem of that tool need not just be other Hilti tools. It could be a whole set of different manufacturing tools which Hilti may not even be making. It could even be competitors. If the idea is that you want to give a broader service to your customer in terms of managing the project for which you are fundamentally selling those tools.
Absolutely. It is so interesting. And I think we can go on about this because there is so much more to say about it and also to bring some new study cases on this. As we are running out of time a little, I would want to ask you, do you have any additional inputs or insights that you want to share on this topic?
Thank you, Branka. No, I too enjoyed this conversation. And I would just, in passing, talk about this concept of what I call digital myopia, which is the inability of many legacy firms to see beyond their strategy as being a product market strategy and the inability to see it as a data digital ecosystem strategy. That is the that is what I call digital myopia. And I talk about, in my book, I talk about five traps of digital myopia, which is, you know, the product trap that, you know, all our revenues come from products. They don't come from data. It's a product trap. Value chain trap, that our business scope is defined by a value chain. We don't see consumption ecosystems. It's a value chain trap. Operational efficiency trap, where all we use data for is to improve efficiencies. We don't see data-driven services. It's the operational efficiency trap. The customer trap. We think of customers as just buying our products. We don't see them as opportunities to get interactive data. And the competitor trap, that is, we see competitors as those who offer similar products. We don't see them as those who may have access to similar data. So these are things that I would leave our listeners with in terms of thinking about what is the new world looking like and what can legacy firms do to expand their thinking beyond products and value chains and industry structures to broader aspects of data and digital ecosystems.
This is so insightful. Thank you so much, Mohan. Thank you very much for taking part in this podcast. I hope I will have you soon again. I also thank our listeners for their attention and I wish you good luck, Mohan. By the way, I just want to mention one thing. The book is super interesting and I can only recommend it because it has all the insights that we just discussed today and beyond that. Mohan, thank you again. And I hope to see you very, very soon.
Thank you, Branka. Same here.
Best wishes.